today on Against the Grain. In the 1950s, the CIA took a keen interest in Kerala, an Indian state that turned communist. I'm C.S. Richard Franke discusses his co-authored book, Toppling the First Ministry, Kerala, the CIA, and the Struggle for Social Justice, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I've been told that I should mark the occasion of my stepping down from my post as regular co-host and co-producer of this program. At the end of the hour, I'll give out a few details about that. I don't plan to step away completely from Against the Grain. But about today's program, when a communist was named chief minister of the state of Kerala in India in 1957, you can bet that the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency took notice. Kerala was already on the CIA's radar screen, but destabilizing and ideally toppling what was called the First Ministry became an important agency objective. How the events of 1957 to 1959 unfolded, what activities were undertaken by the anti-communist opposition in Kerala, and what evidence exists of CIA stances and ambitions vis-a-vis Kerala constitute the focus of a new book by Richard Franke and T.M. Thomas Isaac. It's titled Toppling the First Ministry, Kerala, the CIA, and the Struggle for Social Justice. Dick Franke, my guest today, is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Montclair State University. He and Isaac also co-authored the book People's Planning, Kerala, Local Democracy, and Development. We begin the hour with portions of an interview I conducted with Dick about that earlier book, portions that lay out background and other information covered in and integral to the new book, Toppling the First Ministry. Here's Dick Franke in late 2022 telling me about Kerala.
Kerala is one of the 29 states in India. It has a current population of just a little bit less than 35 million in an area approximately twice the size of the U.S. state of New Jersey. Kerala has a sort of three main geographical areas. It has a long coastline with backwater areas. It has a kind of midlands area where a lot of rice is grown. And then it has a lot of the western Ghat Mountains, which have very steep slopes. And it is covered with coconuts, coconut trees. There must be several million of them.
Is agriculture a big part of Kerala's economy?
Absolutely. In fact, Kerala produces a lot of rice, a lot of coconuts, but also lots of spices. It's historically been part of the spice-producing area. It also gave us our word for teak, which is one of the kinds of furniture-quality wood that's produced there. And in recent years, Kerala has supplemented its agricultural production with medical tourism. It's a very popular place for people from the Western countries, especially with chronic diseases such as chronic pain. And that's become a new important industry there.
So my understanding is that Kerala was created as a state, a state within India, in 1956. What happened in elections held in 1957 in Kerala?
That's a very interesting point to bring up. In the early days of the Indian Federal Republic, there was a kind of reorganization of state boundaries so that they could get mostly people speaking a particular language in one contiguous area. And in the case of Kerala, three areas were clumped together to produce a new state that was inaugurated in 1956. And that meant that the first new democratically elected ministry would be the first one to emerge victorious in the elections that were held in February of 1957. And to the surprise and shock of many, though not everybody, the Indian Communist Party won a majority of the state assembly seats and formed the first ministry, which is known there as the EMS ministry or the first ministry. The letters EMS are the letters for the name of the leader of the Communist Party in Kerala, E.M.S. Nambudiripad, who became the first chief minister.
And how momentous was this election, this democratic election of a communist government in Kerala? Put that in context, perhaps even globally.
This was the height of the Cold War. There was grave concern in the United States about any sort of moves in the direction of anything they could identify as socialism. And of course, the Kerala case was an actual named communist party. So in Washington, this was seen as a very dangerous situation.
Would you characterize the communist formation that came into power in Kerala in 1957 as revolutionary or as reformist? And if reformist, what were the priorities that the government tried to, or the government established?
The Communist Party of India at that time was moving fairly rapidly in the direction of staying within the bounds of the Indian Constitution. A few years back, about 10 or 15 years back, the party had had a revolutionary outlook, and there had been some armed uprisings that were all brutally suppressed. And at this time, the party's philosophy was, now we're talking about from their point of view, it was that if they could improve the lot of ordinary people, it was worth accepting a reformist situation. There were some, I would call, ultra-leftists, both in and outside the party in Kerala, who felt that this was kind of selling out. But the vast majority of the party activists had accepted the new situation, and they went immediately to work after being inaugurated to carry out a variety of very interesting reforms that benefited ordinary people quite a lot.
And which reform programs stood out? And I assume here maybe we're talking about the pretty famous Kerala model of development, which was seen as a model for other areas, regions, countries that wanted to move in a democratic direction?
Yes. The first thing they did on the sixth day in office, the chief minister, EMS Nambudiripad, issued a stay of eviction notice. This was an incredibly important idea to make it impossible for the large landlords to evict or throw off their tenants, which was usually used as a way to terrorize them, the threat of eviction, to terrorize them into submission. And there was tremendous public pressure building up for a land reform that would end evictions. Another thing that they did within a couple of months was to announce, to promulgate a reform of the education system, which was a little bit complicated, but it basically gave teachers rights that they had never had before, and it sort of systematized and regularized the curricula in different schools. Kerala had a lot of mission schools, which taught very different things from the government schools. This particular reform ended up being quite controversial and even playing a role in the eventual dismissal of the ministry. But it was immediately seen by people in Kerala as a great benefit, especially to the teachers. They also promulgated, within the first 2 or 3 months, a new policy on the state police. And that was that the police were not allowed to interfere in any labor disputes. Historically, the police, certainly from a communist point of view, were not just keeping the peace, but were essentially on hire by the big landlords or the employers of any kind. And so by announcing this new police policy, it made it something that, ordinary people who might have been afraid to go on strike because the police would routinely attack picket lines and beat people up with these lathe sticks that they had, kind of like a baseball bat. This was a notorious practice throughout India, but in Kerala, they sort of put an end to it, at least for a while. They also spread the fair price shops to virtually every village, or at least every district. And this was important because although Kerala produces a lot of foreign exchange value through cashew nuts and cardamom and other spices, peppers and so forth, the amount of rice produced is not enough. And therefore, the state has to import rice from other states. And so by having these fair price shops, they were able to reduce the kind of effects when you have a shortage where people will run up prices and you'll get monopolies and other things of that type.
And that was Richard Franke talking with me in late 2022 about a previous book. We re-aired that portion of the interview because it's all relevant to, and much of it is included in, his new co-authored book, co-authored with T.M. Thomas Isaac, Toppling the First Ministry, Kerala, the CIA, and the Struggle for Social Justice. I'm C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and we are joined now by Dick Franke. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Let's turn to the CIA, a central player in this book. The CIA was created in 1947 to do what? To perform what function?
I would say the main function is to protect the U.S. Empire, which emerged from the Second World War when the United States became essentially the world's main superpower, even though the Soviet Union existed. It was never a serious competitor to the United States. The CIA provided intelligence services and also undertook actions sometimes in the service of the U.S. Empire. In the book, we have a section with 6 mini examples, including Guatemala in 1953, Iran in 1953, Indonesia in 1965, and East Timor, connected to the Indonesian case, in 1977, and in Brazil and Congo. I think that, British Guiana. They're examples. Each of them has its own particular properties, but they're all ultimately examples of the use of covert action against mostly independence movements or nationalist movements, and in some cases of communist parties. Many other studies have been done of the CIA in different places. And as a result, a few years ago, Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman wrote a book called The Washington Connection and Third World Fascism, The Political Economy of Human Rights. And in that book, they outlined several of the typical features of a CIA operation, including things like gathering intelligence, of course, but also spreading a lot of money around, especially to hire street crowd, street gangs, organized crime groups, or other groups who could be manipulated. And the use of money was very widespread as a political sort of tactic.
Of the six examples that you mentioned, the six case studies you and T. Thomas Isaac briefly discuss in your book, is there one that stands out in terms of attempts to either take down a government or undermine an established authority?
A major example is the Guatemalan case, when the CIA more or less hired a private army, which they used to overthrow the government of Guatemala, which had been carrying out some very small-scale reforms, including a land reform. And
the Guatemalan leader was Arbenz, is that right?
Jacobo Arbenz, yes.
So the state of Kerala was created, the state of Kerala in India was created in 1956. How, at what point, as far as you know, did the CIA become interested in Kerala's existence and Kerala's leadership?
The CIA and the U.S. government in general were, I think, caught a little bit off guard in 1957 when the Communist Party of India, the Kerala branch, I guess you could say, unexpectedly won the assembly elections and was asked by the Indian president, in accordance with Indian law, to form a ministry that would presumably last for 5 years. However, on the election victory of the Communist Party, as soon as that happened, opposition organizations began to pop up, especially sponsored by the Christian community and to some extent the Catholic Church.
So you mentioned the sort of anti-communist opposition, anti-first ministry opposition that rose after the elections of 1957. Were these oppositional groups working with the CIA, as far as you know?
So the CIA was monitoring everything that was going on, probably across India, but they had a large input of staff and resources in Kerala, because even as early as 1954, there were elections in which the leftist parties won majorities, although they could not maintain them.
And fair to say, the elections in 1954 were in an area that became the state of Kerala, correct?
Yes, it was part of the area was held by a traditional royal family, and until that royal family was kind of decommissioned by the independent Indian state, there was kind of an awareness that the political situation in that area was a little bit unstable. So it was not a surprise to the CIA when the left parties won temporary majorities in 1954.
Tell me more about the development of the anti-communist opposition in Kerala, beginning in 1957 and going forward. What strategies and tactics did the anti-communist opposition engage in?
So the main things that they did was to organize militias and opposition groups of different kinds. The militias, there were sort of two main ones. One was called the Legion of Mary, Mary from the Bible. And the other one was called the Christophers, which was named after an order of the Catholic Church. But the Christophers internationally do not play any role connected to the CIA. Why they chose that name to borrow, I don't know. But they organized demonstrations. They did a lot of training of street fighting and use of lathy sticks that are used for street fighting. Nonetheless, the situation did not really begin to deteriorate. It was still kind of recovering from the temporary election victories of 1954.
And was the opposition to the First Ministry, was it ideological? Or was it because the reforms that were being passed and implemented by the First Ministry, was it that the reforms rubbed people the wrong way or rubbed some people the wrong way?
I think it's kind of both, because the two biggest issues that began very early after the 1957 election victory was the land reform and the education system. And the new ministry that came in 1957, they made the land reform and the school system, the education programs, their biggest priority. In the case of the land reform, they initiated a ban on evictions, which was very important in protecting the poorest tenants in the land reform. And therefore, they did sort of poke the bear. Especially the Catholic Church was very invested in it, in the school system, which was heavily influenced by various churches in the Christian community, but especially the Catholic Church. And the land reform was sort of the major fight that they had been involved in for decades, really.
Richard Franke is my guest. He is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Montclair State University, and he's co-author with T.M. Thomas Isaac of the new book, Toppling the First Ministry, Kerala, the CIA, and the Struggle for Social Justice. It's published by Monthly Review Press. I'm C.S., and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you talked about various opposition forces training people in violent methods. When did violence become a, sort of a key avenue for both expressing protest and for trying to harm or bring down the First Ministry?
Everything kind of moved along at a slow pace in 1957, 1958, and in early 1959, a kind of turning point was reached where a number of the opposition forces, the anti-Communist Party forces, developed violent demonstrations that came fairly quickly. And actually, once these violent confrontations began, the whole situation kind of spiraled out of hand. The Communist Party, since they held state power in this state, the state police were under their command. And the state police were often pretty brutal against the opposition.
Tell us about the two international organizations that helped whip up anti-communist sentiment in Kerala, India.
The Christian Anti-Communism Crusade was an organization that existed in a few places around the world, including British Guiana, And I think they had a small presence for a while in Guatemala. But they were able to build up a fairly big movement, which was centered in Southern California. And it mostly raised money for anti-communist causes. And its leader, Fred Schwartz, was a very dynamic speaker. And they had a newsletter that turned into a weekly newspaper in Kerala, which they were able to raise money for in the United States. How many people they actually recruited is hard to say, but their newspaper claimed subscriptions in the several thousands, and to some extent they did impact the political scene. The other organization is likely to be more familiar to readers of the book. It's called Moral Rearmament. Moral Rearmament is a movement that started out partly in England in the 1920s and 30s, and later became even more widespread in the United States and other places. They had a wing that worked on overcoming alcoholism. They had a wide impact on different groups within the population. But in the late 1950s, as the Communist Party government in Kerala was having some successes, the Moral Rearmament people began building up a big emphasis on anti-communism. And they did not engage in street fighting, but they did publish a newsletter which was widely read, according to them. There have been some questions about whether they told the truth about their accomplishments, but they did add to the kind of hysteria that was building up. You had the Christian anti-communist crusade saying at a certain point communists were going to suddenly take over the whole world and kill all the Christians. You had the Moral Rearmament people pushing theories about how they were going to carry out mass murder of Christians as by taking over the United States.
Now, what could you say, what have you learned about the involvement of the CIA and the U.S. Embassy in India in either helping or in other senses contributing to the anti-communist protests?
I'd like to say a few words about the sources of information, especially for the connection between the CIA and what was happening in Kerala. In 1966, with the passage of the Freedom of Information Act, it became possible in the United States to access an enormous amount of documented information. Much of this information was available in the National Archives. However, over time, more and more of it has been put online. And eventually, the CIA actually created an electronic reading room so that someone like myself could, or you, could actually access the files, of which there are thousands and thousands. But the CIA materials are somewhat limited because there's a clause in the Freedom of Information Act that allows for the classification of documents so that you could find a document and try to access it only to find out that it has been classified, which means that it has been removed from access. You can't access it. So you know that it's there, but you can't get it. Or in some unusual situations, it's possible to get them to declassify a particular document if you suspect that it has a lot of information.
So based on your access to information that had not been classified, that you did have access to through this reading room and I think other sources, what did you discover? What were your main findings?
Our main findings were that the CIA was keeping a very close watch on Kerala at a level of frequent contributions to the reading room, the electronic reading room materials. But the main thing that we found was that the CIA was and the U.S. Embassy were, by 1957 already, had begun to lay the groundwork for covert actions against Kerala. I want to tell you about how we discovered one particular document that turned out to be of major significance in terms of our study. In 2007, we began this research. We spent time in the government documents section of Montclair State University. There was a document there called a FRUS document, F-R-U-S, Foreign Relations of the United States. FRUS is a giant database of all foreign policy materials that have to do with the United States. There's actually 18 different organizations in the U.S. government that are constantly monitoring information internationally. And the FRUS documents are the State Department's main repository. They have 300,000 documents there. And so we were moving through some of these documents and discovered a number that had information about Kerala. But we found one document that was about 5 pages long and had a lot of detailed information about Kerala and the situation there in the late 1950s. But when we tried to view the document, we found out it was classified. And so we thought at first that we were stymied, but then we noticed there was a footnote at the bottom of the page saying that for classified documents, you can ask for the rest of the document, the classified part of the document. That was in 2007. We made an appeal letter to try to get the rest of the document opened up and didn't hear anything until 2013. So it was actually a little over 6 years between our request and getting a copy of the document. But the document is important because there's never been a documented source that talked about using covert action in Kerala. And once we got this document, we saw that there were several references to covert action, to the use of covert action, and to working with the government of India to essentially unseat the Kerala communist government.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My guest is Dick Franke, F-R-A-N-K-E. He is co-author with T.M. Thomas Isaac of the new book, Toppling the First Ministry, Kerala, the CIA, and the Struggle for Social Justice. So was covert action actually taken by the CIA in relation to the First Ministry in Kerala?
The covert action was not actually carried out until a later time. It was being proposed, actually. In fact, here's what this document's, what part of what it says. It is in the U.S. national interest that a moderate, non-communist government, basically oriented toward the free world, succeed in consolidating the allegiance of the Indian people. Then there's a break. It is therefore in the interests of U.S. policy objectives in India, as well as South Asia, that the present communist government in Kerala fail to achieve any further successes which might enhance its prestige, and that it be removed from power with the least possible delay. And I added emphasis that it be removed from power with the least possible delay. And a couple pages later, one example of some additional material here. The U.S. will offer assistance for requests from the Indian government for assistance, overt or covert. This material is all contained in a telegram titled Instruction from the Department of State to the Diplomatic Missions in India. It reads, in addition, secret the United States policy with regard to Kerala. So the discussion of covert action is to be undertaken under instructions from the Department of State, which I think ties it even more closely together with the CIA project.
I see. You're saying that it wasn't just a CIA initiative, that the State Department, another key agency entity of the U.S. government, was involved or aware or collaborating in some way.
Yes.
Dick, at one point you traveled to the Dwight D. Eisenhower Presidential Library in Abilene, Kansas. There you found a box notable for what it does not contain.
That's correct. The Eisenhower Library is mostly still not yet in digital form, so you have to go and sit at a desk and thumb through printed papers. And some of the papers are in boxes with numbers on them. There's a large amount of them, but after a couple of days of going through documents, we came upon a kind of strange, it was a box that was empty, except that if you opened it up, one sheet of paper came out, and it says in capital letters, all documents within this folder are exempted in full from declassification and released by the National Security Council staff. And in addition, on the sheet of paper is a handwritten note that a request had been made to declassify this, and it had been rejected. So we know that someone else knows the existence of this document, and hopefully someone will eventually be able to pry it loose so we can find out the answer to a very important question. Because during the months of June, July, and August 1959, there was tremendous turmoil in Kerala, including street fighting. A number of people were killed. A number of buses and cars were burnt. Buildings were attacked by hysterical anti-communist forces and so forth. And there's no place that documents all of that, but in this sheet, it lists the timetable for this, where it's blocked, where you can't get the information, corresponds exactly to those dates, June, July, and August of 1959. So what they're doing is they won't let you see that. It's the only thing in the whole folder that is forbidden.
So what's the legacy, do you think, of the CIA's interest in Kerala, its expressed interest in conducting covert action in Kerala? What's the legacy of that and of the dismissal of the First Ministry in 1959 as far as Kerala going forward, Kerala post-1959?
The aftermath of the dismissal of the ministry was several decades of political instability, but Kerala kept coming back. The right wing would form a ministry, and then the left would win elections, and they tended in each election victory to the left side would carry out some kind of major reform. In one decade, it was the land reform. In another decade, it was the pensions for agricultural workers. And more recently, they have, they claim at least, to have abolished extreme poverty, which is something no other Indian state has been able to achieve. So part of the legacy is that they were able to maintain these and carry out this whole series of reforms despite having been undermined by these movements of hysterical Christians and the machinations of the CIA.
I'm realizing we haven't talked about the circumstances of the dismissal of Kerala's first ministry in 1959. Tell us about that, and perhaps you want to add more about its aftermath.
So the dismissal was something that had been talked about in many other CIA documents about Kerala, that this would be the most effective and efficient way to solve the problem, would have for the central government under Nehru to simply dismiss the ministry on the grounds that they couldn't maintain law and order, which was sort of true, but a kind of ironic way for it to occur. What happened in the aftermath was that many of the reforms that had drawn so many people to the Kerala ministry, reforms were either undone to the extent possible or were greatly watered down. The land reform was essentially put on hold. The school reforms were undone. It looked like Kerala was sort of out of business. They held an election in 1960, and that election, the Congress government won in coalition with the Muslim Party and several of the anti-communist groups. And it looked like the Kerala experiment was coming to an end. But since that time, over the years, they've made a comeback, been set back, made another comeback, and Kerala today has a much higher income than many other states in India. It has the same or higher standards of living. They've actually, over the course of the several decades up to the present time, they've been able to carry out many of the reforms. They've improved the public health system a lot. They have the highest quality educational standards for the whole country. So the Kerala experiment looks to be alive, and the dismissal of the government back in 1959 was a setback, but one that they've overcome to a large extent.
The voice of Richard Franke, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Montclair State University in New Jersey, co-author with T.M. Thomas Isaac of People's Planning, Kerala, Local Democracy and Development. We've been talking about their new book, right? The book co-authored by Dick and Thomas. The new book is Toppling the First Ministry, Kerala, the CIA, and the Struggle for Social Justice. Dick, thanks very much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity to share some of our experiences. The Kerala model continues to be quite inspiring.
And we have time to present a bit more of my conversation with Dick in 2022. These excerpts are about initiatives that were women-focused. After elections in 1987 that once again brought the Communist Party to power in Kerala, they launched a program called the New Democratic Initiatives.
One of the organizations that they turned to, which had a lot of pro-party people in it already, is an organization known in English as the KSSP, the Kerala People's Science Movement. This was a movement of scientists to try to spread scientific thinking into the villages of Kerala. And they began working on an array of different things, trying to analyze problems and bring up possible solutions. And this was also a characteristic of the 1957 ministry, that they tried to identify what were the problems that people were suffering from the most. So one of the things that came out of that was several of the activists were trained in engineering, and they designed what are called smokeless chulas, or smokeless ovens. They spent a lot of time and put a lot of resources into this, and they were able to design, these are still in operation, they were able to design ovens that were very low pollution. One study found that the typical Indian kitchen, where the woman would be cooking for 2 to 3 hours maybe every day, that being in there with a traditional fire to fire this oven was more or less the equivalent of smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. And so this was a kind of alternative development project that dealt with people's real needs, with serious problems that they had. And they were able not only to design a very low polluting oven, but again, because they were part of this giant political movement, they were able to run a campaign to popularize it that was very successful.
A part of your book focuses on the award-winning Kudumba Shri Network. It is, as I understand it, a women's neighborhood network that includes microcredit, social enterprise activities, skills training, a marketing scheme for its products. Tell us about Kudumba Shri and why it's so significant.
Kudumba Shri has been so successful in reducing poverty that it is being actually copied in some Indian states and has been promoted somewhat by the United Nations. It is, as you say, it is a network of women-owned cooperatives connected to local cooperative banks, and they organize these production cooperatives primarily for local products. So, for example, they manufacture soap, umbrellas, school uniforms for kids, and some of them are now setting up tea shops along the national highway. that are also run as worker-owned cooperatives. And when they looked at the lowest income groups, one of the things they noticed was that most of them, the woman did not work. And they realized that this was very significant because the men who were working to do things to increase their wages is difficult, whereas the women, if they went from not working to working, would add quantitatively more income to the family. And so they built the whole program around creating employment for women. And it has worked remarkably well.
Richard Franke talking with me about his book, People's Planning. A little bit about me. I will be stepping down from my position as regular co-host and co-producer of Against the Grain at the end of this month. After December 1st, you might hear my voice now and then. I plan to occasionally sit in for Sasha, who I'm delighted to say will be taking over as this program's sole host. I've been told I should somehow mark the occasion of my sort of farewell. So next Tuesday, November 25th, on our home station, I'll be sharing some thoughts about what I've done or have tried to do over the last 2+ decades. I'll also talk about my process and my approach to producing and interviewing, and I'll offer some advice on the craft of interviewing and maybe even some life advice. I'll also present excerpts of interviews that have made a special impression on me. So, sort of a retrospective with some commentary about things I've never really talked about because I never wanted my opinions or modus operandi to be a focus of this program. That's next Tuesday, November 25th, on our home station. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more.